Thank you for tuning in. In today's episode, we speak with entrepreneur Jesse Schrader, who helps us understand how Bitcoin payments are scaling through the Bitcoin Lightning Network. Although some parts of the conversation get a bit technical, Jesse does a great job in explaining the pros and cons and what they are working on at Amboss Technologies. As a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only.
Welcome to another episode of Build with Bitcoin podcast. Today, I'm your host, Israel Munoz. I'm joined with the co-host, Lynn Berstow. Today, we're joined with Jesse Schrader from Amboss Technologies. Jesse, we're very much looking forward to today's conversation. Jesse is an engineer working on a series of tools to optimize the Bitcoin Lightning Network. We'll get into what all of that means, but as a starting point, Jesse, we've gathered you have a pretty interesting story on how you got to where you are today. So, what if we go through that? Who are you? What were you working on before Bitcoin, and what inspired you to dive into the Bitcoin startup space?
Sure, and thanks so much for having me to dive into this story and bring your unique perspective here. But overall, my background was. After studying environmental engineering, I was focused on like wastewater treatment and in environmental engineering, you generally study dams and how to manage the flows of those and ensure you've got like enough capacity for this dam and whatnot. But after graduating, I ended up taking a job doing some class action lawsuits, and I learned a bit more about the traditional finance system and how the customers of banks were sometimes subject to some policies that banks would introduce, reorganizing debit card transactions to maximize overdraft fees. I saw that policy and I saw the class action lawsuit about it, and it really planted some seeds in my mind about, well, what if we had a different system where, customers weren't subject to policies that were sometimes not customer friendly? And eventually I stumbled onto Bitcoin, that it was an alternative where people could recapture that control and help drive their future where they set the policies, where they could be in full control. And that's really what the Bitcoin technology offers for not only people in the U.S., but all around the world, where they could have a more advanced financial system and be able to leverage that. So that's really how I got started. And after encountering Andreas Antonopoulos and learning about some of the deeper tech.
And from the wastewater treatment to your job with the class action lawsuits, it was at the class action lawsuits, seeing some of the, I guess, misbehavior in the banking system that kind of got you curious about the Bitcoin network, or had you already heard of it beforehand and kind of had reacquainted yourself with it then? How did that play out?
Yeah, in order to get into Bitcoin, it requires a couple of touches, as we say. So I had heard about it from a friend, and I had tried to buy some initially. I tried to send money to Mt. Gox using my Wells Fargo card, and Wells Fargo denied the transaction, preventing me from buying Bitcoin. I think this was back in 2014, and there it was very clear already, but it wasn't obvious to me at that point that you don't control your own money. It's your banks that really, they have custody and they have control over the money. And I'm subject to their policies. Now, the only other alternative for me was to send cash to Japan, where Mt. Gox was located. And that sounds like a scam. So you probably shouldn't be doing that. However, that would have been my first purchase of Bitcoin, but I didn't actually buy Bitcoin until many years later when Bitcoin operates in 4-year cycles generally. And so I caught the next one in 2017.
Okay. Okay. And I'm guessing you didn't stay long at the temporary job with the class action lawsuits.
I didn't. Yeah, I think I spent like a couple of years there, kind of getting a bit more familiar, but then the economy recovered after 2008 and I was able to move more into engineering, more on the transportation side.
Okay. And what were you doing there?
That was more asset management for the state highway system. And so that it has interesting parallels to what I do now, in the Lightning Network, because Lightning is an asset allocation problem, but it's basically like, you know, where are you going to prioritize resources to maintain the highway system? And so primarily we were doing data collection all across the highway network to prioritize spending.
Okay. And you know, I don't mean to get off onto too big of a tangent here, but you said it there's some parallels between a transportation system and what you're doing now. How do those compare? Why do you think there's some relevancy there?
If maybe it's a good time to just say exactly what MBOS is and describe a little bit about the company and the mission of that.
Sure. So MBOS got started because Bitcoin has a scalability problem. When you go to send a transaction, Bitcoin, the protocol itself, can really only process about 7 transactions per second. And the most hopeful technology for scalability of Bitcoin is the Lightning Network.
Can I just interject now? And that is by design, correct? That's in order to keep the Bitcoin network as stable and secure as possible. So from the origin of Bitcoin, it was understood that it would need other technologies built alongside, parallel or on top of Bitcoin in order to increase that transaction amount. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, there's a ton of different trade-offs in Bitcoin's design. So you could add more data into each block, but then that causes fewer people to actually be able to participate fully and run their own node. And then there's different scaling ways to, you know, increase the amount of blocks per time. And that causes more instability in the coordination for the global coordination of the network. So there's different trade-off pieces here. And I think where Bitcoin landed is an area of consensus where everyone that participates in Bitcoin agrees that this is the right setup for the protocol of money to enhance that security and enhance decentralization. But it does have limitations. As Nick Bhatia has said, who's a, you know, economist working on this space, that Bitcoin should scale in layers. And so what we've introduced with Lightning is a second layer on Bitcoin that allows peer-to-peer transactions. And, you know, Lightning is much more relational. So instead of having a transaction be broadcasted to the entire world, it's just between two people or two different entities that use Bitcoin and run a node. And the connection between those two is a Lightning channel, which is, you can think of that just like a joint account. And any payments that are made via Lightning are simply an update to the payout of this joint account. And that's a nice way to think about things. But that setup is similar to like payment channels, which we would see from someone like Starbucks, for example, offering gift cards. Now, that enables a business like Starbucks to basically in-house their payment processing. That's a massive advantage for a company that generally sells coffee, but suddenly starts to look like a bank and has access to this financial innovation here using payment channels. So Lightning provides a similar opportunity for anyone using Bitcoin to enhance the scalability of those transactions. And move more into financial services, and the markets associated with that.
And just to maybe place a parenthesis here, it's providing some scalability because all of these settlements are happening. They're not all happening on the base layer, right? So it's a bunch of accounting ledgers that only net settle every X frequency with the base layer, right? So just, I mean, and I think there's probably many, many examples in the traditional systems today, or in, you know, what we use day to day, that have maybe some similar mechanisms going on whenever we're, you know, maybe settling up some debts, or maybe using, I don't know, Splitwise as a group, or at a bar or a restaurant, and we only actually transact with that net settlement at the end. I mean, is that fair to say on how you see it, Jesse, or just kind of, you know, simplifying it? How is it that Lightning helps Bitcoin scale?
Yeah. So when you use a blockchain, every node on that network basically has to coordinate. And Bitcoin uses, you know, proof of work to coordinate. Now, when you broadcast a transaction to the Bitcoin network, that's coordinating over 20,000 different nodes that are, you know, globally distributed. But making that payment channel infrastructure that Lightning uses means that you only need to coordinate between two people. So that's basically as small as you could get. So you could have, you know, frictionless finance. And those relationships are interoperable. So if I need to involve more people, I can. And I can kind of send a payment through the Lightning Network, and a payment can hop between different parties that I'm connected to. And it allows me to essentially take the settlement that we're used to, the settlement that basically takes 2 weeks every time you swipe your card, or a certain like percentage of your debit card transaction, to basically go to another party that's going to manage your finance. But for Lightning, we can make transactions happen under a second, and that is final settlement without involving a whole bunch of other people that are kind of looking at your transactions. So really, it's taking it down to bare bones and optimizing for speed and the cost of transactions, where a Lightning Network transaction might cost 0.005%.
And just to put into context, I believe it was around 2015, correct me if I'm wrong, Lynn or Jesse, around then, that the Lightning Network first was, I believe the white paper was published. And then, you know, fast forward 2-3 years later, we're talking about maybe around 2018 that it started getting going. So we're very much at the early stages of this scaling solution, and others as well, right, Jesse? So why Lightning? What drew your attention to Lightning?
Well, I noticed some issues with Lightning. If you're going to select a peer and you want to get connected, basically how am I supposed to get in contact with that other person? And that was the genesis of AmBoss getting created. It's helping. Now we've got these decentralized network, but how are they supposed to get in contact with each other? How are they supposed to discover each other? And that's a fundamental problem of decentralized networks, is discoverability. And so the first product that AmBoss launched was the AmBoss.space Lightning Network Explorer, where you can go there, find out about the people that you're considering making a connection with and creating your own micro ledger joint account to use Bitcoin in a frictionless way. Now, so we started AmBoss.space, and you can also track basically the whole economy of the Lightning Network, which it does have its own economy. The second piece we launched was a marketplace for liquidity, because Lightning doesn't use credit or debt. Basically, you have to have enough liquidity to process transactions. And so those were the two pieces that AmBoss really helps solve, is discoverability and liquidity. And with those two, you can make transactions happen in a much more seamless way.
How long had you been using or operating in Lightning prior to starting AmBoss? And you have a co-founder too, so can you tell me a little bit about how you two came together to start AmBoss?
Sure. So I started using Lightning in 2018, and really got into it in 2019. And that's when a lot of the tools started to come online. One of the major tools is called ThunderHub. And that's what my now co-founder, Tony, had developed. And ThunderHub is an open source node manager. So it helps you manage all of those connections that you have on Lightning. You know, ThunderHub as an open source tool was really important because it needs to be open source, but it also introduced a problem that open source tools and software are sometimes difficult to monetize. Like AMBOSS essentially was created to be like a monetization arm for ThunderHub to, you know, provide long-term support for ThunderHub.
So then if you think of AMBOSS is really like a company that has different products in it. So Spaces being, or AMBOSS Space being the visualization tool that allows you to get a perspective of the whole network, and then the marketplace. And so is the trajectory of AMBOSS to continue to develop products for Lightning node operators and for the community?
Yeah. In a way, we're functioning a bit like Google and a bit like Waze. So generally, like we crowdsource information from the Lightning Network to help it coordinate. And so the first piece was discoverability with the AMBOSS Space Explorer. We've got our marketplace, which we call Magma. We've also got automation services to just make this easier. Because I think for most people, they don't want to be thinking about Lightning channels and liquidity and all of these pieces, but that is ripe for automation. And so that's where we've been focused primarily. More recently, we learned that banks and financial institutions will not use this technology unless they can be completely in the clear when it comes to risk and compliance. We recently launched a product called Reflex, which does basic due diligence checks and helps ring fence an enterprise's operations for risk purposes. Just to say that you are not participating in money laundering or terrorist financing, but you are still using the best available financial settlement technology. So that kind of paves the path for some truly explosive growth within the Lightning Network. And this is just to kind of further the institutional adoption of Bitcoin, putting those tools together and answering the different problem areas of Lightning as a technology and working around it is really how AMBOSS is positioned for growth and success of Bitcoin, the Lightning Network, and as a company.
And we're recording this in early June 2024, and in the recent weeks, there's been a lot of activity in the regulatory space inside of the U.S. against companies that have privacy tools that are related to Bitcoin in particular and crypto in general. And so the stance is really coming to a head in terms of visibility and ensuring this sort of regulatory. When did you launch Reflex and have you seen your clients reacting to this? Because at Matron, I guess just taking a step back, Lightning is more private in the way transactions are made than the Bitcoin. On the Bitcoin blockchain, people tend to, you know, misthink it and think that it's used for money laundering, this and that. But it's one of the more visible ledgers of how transactions go between nodes or between individuals, and they can be tracked. But Lightning provides a layer of privacy, which is why many people choose to use Lightning for transactions, and especially in smaller amounts for the liquidity and privacy. Can you speak to that a little bit? I can feel a lot there about
sure. Maybe
privacy and how that's impacting your clients.
There's a lot of components to it, because here we are with consumers that have grown up with Venmo, and they've grown up where all of their transactions are surveilled. So that's where we're at right now. And that transaction data is used to sell them ads. That's surveillance capitalism that we've experienced. Now, Bitcoin and Lightning provide a fundamental switch in that, where you can have transaction level privacy. Now, that's a tremendous win for consumers. But when you go to talk about larger businesses, enterprises, the privacy that is involved suddenly becomes a bit of a liability that they're going to have to explain. So the thinking with Reflex is that you can ring fence your operations and still use the technology that consumers want that has, you know, privacy benefits without participating or without being lumped in with money laundering and terrorism. So like that was the real thinking, because we have to pave the path for explosive growth of, you know, Bitcoin being used for transactions and allowing Bitcoin to scale. Lightning has the scalability benefits, and it also has privacy benefits by default. So finding a hybrid there where we can crowdsource information, prove operations, but also ring fence an enterprise's operations against participating in illicit finance.
Yeah, I mean, what you're doing there, I think, is super critical to the points that Lynn is making, because I do see, I mean, it's very clear to see that regulators currently have a bit of an education gap, and I do think a lot of it is just that it's not necessarily, you know, them trying to destroy a new industry, but you need players like yourself to, you know, form some sort of middle ground. There's a lot of this gray zone that I think what Amboss is doing with something like Reflex will definitely help the comfort level of institutions, right, wanting to participate.
Yeah, you can basically just look at where banks and financial institutions spend their money, and they spend $181 billion every year on compliance tools. Like that is basically that's what they do to protect their business model. Now, everybody is subject to, you know, financial rules and regulations, but, you know, our thinking is, well, why don't we just start automating those processes from day one as these businesses enter the Lightning Network and start enjoying, you know, faster, lower risk payments and, you know, be able to do so in a compliant way that works for their rules and regulations.
So that's Reflex, the risk management / compliance tool, right? Before that, you had touched on the Explorer and Marketplace. You had made an interesting comparison to Google Waze. For those not familiar, Waze is similar to Google Maps. And in the beginning of the conversation, I kind of want to get back to that, because I do find it interesting. You said that your work with the transportation side had some interesting parallels. So why does a transportation network or a Waze comparison relate to payments and payment routing?
Yeah. When I talk about nodes and channels, you could think of a node like a city and a channel as a highway between them. Now, Waze is a way for a driver to communicate about traffic issues or something on the road. And then Waze as a company is able to use that information to provide better routing for a driver. Now, we can do the same thing for payments themselves. So we can crowdsource information about liquidity, kind of like a traffic report, and make better payment routes. We've been using machine learning to take that information and leverage it for the rest of the network to provide better payment reliability and better pathfinding. And people can use that pathfinding service to have, you know, better, faster, cheaper payments. By using machine learning, we were able to, and we're doing benchmarking studies currently, we're able to move LND is the, you know, dominant protocol. That payment reliability out of the box is 27%. Now we have to compete with, you know, Visa and MasterCard at 99.99%. But by using our machine learning and our pathfinding, we were able, and these are early results, but we were able to bring that up to 90%. So this is a step change improvement by using machine learning and by crowdsourcing information to provide more reliable payments for Lightning.
And that's for optimizing the route of a payment, right, Jesse, that you're speaking to? Okay, so just like in Waze or Google Maps, when I want to get to destination B and it gives me, you know, oh, you can take this path is 5 minutes longer, this path has tolls, there's an accident here. It's a similar comparison in a way?
Yeah. So if 27% of, you know, payments were successful, 27% of routes actually got you to the destination and the rest of them brought you to a dead end. Like, that's basically the state of Lightning today, where you don't want to get stuck at a dead end. You want to get to your destination. So providing that better routing is going to be critical for the growth of the network. And so we're really excited to battle test this with some participating enterprises that make a high volume of payments and want better payment reliability.
So I want to kind of bring up here, since you mentioned Visa and reliability, a lot of people might ask the question, well, if Visa works so well, why do we need an alternative payment provider? But one of the things that I'm most excited about, the potential of Lightning and Bitcoin, are micropayments and social payment layer. It allows through sats, these incredibly small amounts to be sent efficiently, where a Visa will charge a fee that makes a small payment not worthwhile to make. But this provides the ability of transferring small amounts. Think of it in usage, like in Waze, and Waze may not be a good example, but if you have streaming of Spotify or Netflix, you're paying a monthly fee for streaming, but if you could pay for you're paying for the whole network, for the whole mapping network, for the whole road system. But if you only paid for the small amounts of roads that you're going on and you paid for those reliable ones, I think it's just important to talk about the potential. I mean, I just look at this as a massive potential change in how we pay for services that we use. And so having these efficient roadways, I guess it allows the skateboards and the bikes to be able to use the same roadways as a 18-wheeler, you know, but because you're making micropayments on it. Do you have thoughts on that, or how do you view that as a component of the Lightning network in terms of how it grows?
Yeah, it's huge. So on the one hand, you know, payment cards in general, you know, generally a 10-cent fee every time you swipe your card. You know, merchants are having to pay those fees plus, you know, a fee based on the size of the transaction. And they bake those in the prices. And one of the biggest issues of the past years has been inflation, where prices are going up, consumer prices are going up. And we're very rarely talking about the efficiency of the payment system. And, you know, part of the cost that merchants incur is not only the processing, but also chargebacks. So that's going to change, because with Lightning, you have final settlement. There are no chargebacks. And you're also increasing the transaction speed. So you've got final transactions happening in a second versus settlement happening 2 weeks later. The other thing, and this is something, you know, we experience. I was processing my mid-month payroll for Amboss to pay our employees. And the money was withdrawn from our account by the payment processor. And I learned that Silicon Valley Bank went bankrupt. And, you know, they had a bank run. My payroll provider asked me to resend the payroll amount. So that's half a month of payroll that had essentially disappeared. Like, what do you mean you need me to send it again, because it's gone and it's not in my employees' accounts? And that was a clear indicator to me that there is counterparty risk in the traditional finance system, simply because, you know, the processing takes too long and it's not final. Lightning fixes that. And it also brings the cost of transactions lower. So it makes possible the idea of streaming payments. So you could essentially make a payment every minute. You could make a payment every 5 minutes. Who would want to get paid actually every single hour that you're, you know, working your job? That becomes possible, and reducing some of these cash flow issues that a lot of folks experience without introducing new risk from credit and debt.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like the network is just getting more and more efficient, right? And another component, which is super important to also remember and highlight, I think, is apart from the efficiency gains of just comparing network A to B, as far as, you know, transaction costs and speed, et cetera, the accessibility side is something that we, you know, sometimes just kind of forget to mention or hover above. But we're talking about an open network, right? A permissionless network. So there are no gatekeepers. So part on top of this evolving efficient network from a cost and speed perspective, there's a large part of the world, especially in underdeveloped nations or societies, where, you know, I may not, even if I want to, I may not have access to a Visa credit card, right? I may not have access to a bank account. So on top of the efficiency gains, we're talking about a network that's open to anyone with a cell phone, basically, right?
I'm so glad you brought that up. I mean, basically forget about US and Europe, because they already are very financialized and we have, you know, a regulated system. But for the rest of the world, like, they don't have those benefits of, you know, being, you know, financialized. You know, in East Asia, there's very few payment processors or like credit, debit card payments. So it's, you're kind of left with a cash economy. But having an app-based payment system that is possible with Lightning, you know, makes it so that, you know, similar to, you know, skipping over phone lines and just going directly to internet, like, we have another opportunity here. We're watching folks like Machin Kura bring payments to Africa using the USSD network, which is not a, it's not a currency. It's how your flip phone talks to the cell phone towers. And so Machin Kura has brought those types of, has brought Lightning payments to flip phones. So this is not a super high tech thing that is inaccessible to the world. This is bringing Bitcoin and better money to the rest of the world.
Yeah, I mean, both Israel and I have roots in LATAM, and so I'm based in Mexico City, and Israel was born in Mexico City, but now lives in the States. And so I think we talk often about this, how the perspective, sometimes you find, especially in investing in Bitcoin companies and the entrepreneurship right now, I think it is very much concentrated still in the U.S. and possibly because that's just always been the fertile ground for entrepreneurship and thinking about new ideas. But the solutions are being provided in many cases for the rest of the world, where the use of Bitcoin and Lightning and different branches of the technology are so much more robust and creative and utilitarian than they are in the U.S., which tends to be strictly a savings vehicle or an investment vehicle or a digital asset that, you know, right, people think of it as a product or a stock, and it blows our minds. We love seeing this. But can you talk a little bit about, do you see geographically, I don't know, I mean, I know Lightning nodes are all over the world, but do you have any sense of geographically where your users are, or how you, you know, how you approach thinking about that?
Yeah, we generally see Bitcoin adoption happen in pockets. So you need kind of a hotspot to really bootstrap a circular economy. What we see is Bitcoin Jungle in Costa Rica has been one of the biggest and most successful adoption stories of Bitcoin for payments. And Bitcoin Jungle uses our liquidity marketplace to actually provide the liquidity for its users. And, you know, talking to Lee at Bitcoin Jungle, you know, he's it's grown to the point where he hasn't even met all of the merchants that have adopted, you know, his wallet and his payment system there in Costa Rica. There you can live off of Bitcoin. There's also you know, pockets in El Salvador that have been talked about quite a bit. And you know, we're on the lookout for different, you know, hotspots that are going to pop up that really use Bitcoin for payments. Early on in Amboss's story, we enabled communities on Lightning. So different nodes can participate and join different communities. And we saw lots of adoption in Japan. There's a community called Diamond Hands, which is like a whole bunch of Japanese nodes that are working together and making better payments, you know, within their country. So we're seeing adoption somewhat like that on more of the technical scale instead of like on the ground. But it's going to happen both places. We also saw a whole bunch of, you know, what we call them plebs, connecting to El Salvador when El Salvador adopted Bitcoin as a currency. They were thinking about the transaction cost of Bitcoin on chain at, you know, $3 at the time, thinking that's too much for El Salvador. And it caused an influx of people wanting to support El Salvador's decision to make Bitcoin legal tender. And that's when we saw this influx of liquidity to the Lightning Network, trying to support payments going to folks in El Salvador.
You know, maybe we can shift to the conversation a little more towards the startup story and the fundraising, what that experience has been for you, Jesse. I mean, it'd be great to get your take, especially as a first-time founder. You know, correct me on any of these dates, but to my understanding, Ambas launched in 2021. And you raised a seed round last year in 2023, led by a pretty well-known venture capital Bitcoin fund, Stillmark. What can you share a little bit about what the fundraising process has been like for you? How did you get going? How difficult was it to raise those initial funds, and what it's been like working with a Bitcoin venture capital fund?
Sure. You know, for us as Bitcoiners, there's not a ton of VC capital that is floating around. And the community is relatively small for the size of the asset. Can you imagine the VC space and for the US dollar is, you know, huge compared to the same thing for Bitcoin. So what we see is, you know, generally folks are underinvesting in Bitcoin ventures. So It was a challenge to, one, communicate, you know, why we're building on this technology. And it's because, you know, this is money for the world. It has incredible disruptive power. And also, you know, how are we going to make it scale? And why are we building on Lightning? So answering those questions, in addition to speaking about the merits of Ambas, you know, as a data analytics provider and a tool builder that, you know, helps make this technology as disruptive as it can be. So communicating all of that is a real challenge in, you know, a 20-minute pitch call, and also getting connected to folks that are able to help a company like Ambas evolve out of the, you know, tiny Bitcoin space and have more generalist appeal. Because, you know, why should it only be VCs that are able to access the gains and the growth of the Bitcoin space? We're doing our best to communicate the merits of this, so that we can get more access for the rest of the VC space, more of the generalist variety. Working with Stillmark was a game changer for us because, you know, Elise Killeen and Vikash Singh at Stillmark, you know, deeply understand data systems and have, you know, a keen focus on Bitcoin, Lightning, and machine learning. And they've been instrumental to our success. You know, we're looking forward to working even more closely with them. They were fundamental for our machine learning research to improve payment reliability. And we've also worked with Valor Equity Partners to work on sales processes, and we're honored to have Draper Associates also participate in our most recent round.
So then these VCs are really working with you at a strategic level too. So in addition to providing capital, they're partners with you in your growth and helping lead your thinking about the growth process.
Exactly. Let's see, some of the advice I got early on is to, you know, strategically construct your cap table. And I'm so glad I got that advice because, you know, all of the investors that we've had, we've got good relationships with and are able to, you know, make introductions and help grow Ambas as a company and reach the rest of the world, get in contact with the right people.
Yeah, and it's hard for first-time founders to raise funds, and you've been really successful at it. And I'd love to hear you give some advice. I mean, one of the things that we're hoping to do is to encourage more startups to be looking at developing on Bitcoin and building with Bitcoin, because we think it is such an important technology. Bitcoin, Lightning, Nostra, the related distributed systems that we think will really be foundational for technology the evolution in the future. But what's it like as a first-time founder? I mean, when you went out to fundraise, it's hard for experienced founders. How did you get introduced to the, luckily the Bitcoin VC space is small. So it's, there are a few people to contact. And we really have tremendous respect for Stillmark and what they've done and being a focus in the space early on. But how did you personally, you and Tony, approach fundraising? How'd you get the connections to make the presentations and the pitches? Can you give some kind of tactical advice on this aspect?
Sure. When Tony and I launched Amboss, we weren't really thinking about taking on investor capital, but we went down to El Salvador for the Adopting Bitcoin conference. So this is right after El Salvador had adopted Bitcoin as legal tender. We made a presentation and suddenly there was investor interest. Say, wait, what are these Amboss guys doing? Tell me more. Where are you thinking of going next? And they could see the opportunity pretty clearly. For us, we still had, some work to do to really like hone our message about, the strategic decision making and the economic opportunity there. So for us, taking what we knew about problems with the technology that we're building on, and forming those into defined products, and getting those initial intros. Huge thanks to Han Hua, now at Google Ventures, for like making those initial intros. I really had to learn warm intros are key to actually getting into this space. You have to know someone and you have to be introduced. You can't just, send out cold emails to everyone. You will get ignored. However, investors are, very subject to signaling and for good reason, because as we were, speaking about before, there may not be very many late stage opportunities for investing in Bitcoin companies, because many of them hold Bitcoin, the asset. And as that asset grows in value, they may not have the need for venture capital at a later stage, and they will be holding Bitcoin. And so the value, similar to like MicroStrategy's treasury strategy, they may not need additional cash. The cash may be a liability. Like early stage VC makes a lot of sense for the Bitcoin space and the Lightning space, where you've got tremendous growth opportunities, both on the asset and the technology front.
Yeah, I love that. I just want to drill down and just kind of bookmark that thought, because, as we're talking, as Israel and I are talking to more people and having conversations on the podcast, we are finding this trend. And I think it's a beautiful trend, because even in VC, you tend to put, to have the larger funds focused on A and B rounds and C rounds. And many VCs, it's tough. It's tough to be able to pick a company that has the team, the idea, the ability to execute, to take a company profitable. So it's easier to invest at a later stage, when scalability is really what you're after, but the thought has been proven. But in the Bitcoin space, I do agree. I think the sweet spot is going to be early stage, because you may not have the same opportunities that you have in traditional tech to get in on later rounds. There just may not be the need by the company to take on investors at that point.
It's a great point, because Bitcoin is being adopted faster than the internet. So there's tremendous growth from the boom of the internet, and it may just be that the window is quite short to actually get participation in some of these disruptive companies. That said, we do have to build early. Before the real rush happens, at the early stage, it might be difficult to show the traditional metrics. We're going to see kind of the market just come and the dam just explodes, with kind of the adoption of this currency and this technology. So we have to build early, but not too early. So it's like, it's always a balance, but that's what, makes it a good fit for early stage VC.
So I know you recently raised or closed around last year, your seed round, but how are you thinking about your future? I mean, you really have a great suite of products already. I'm sure that as Lightning Network evolves, you'll see other issues that need to, you know, or benefits that you can bring to the table in terms of tools and usability. But how are you thinking about the growth of MVOS and the future funding needs for those investors who want to get in?
Sure. Let's see. So we do have, you know, so much more to build because, of course, we want to, you know, support this network and capture value and return those to investors and give them more opportunities to get access to this space and to the growth. You know, we are interested in taking on more venture capital, especially from strategic investors. And, you know, that's going to be critical for our growth so that we're, you know, well positioned to really capture one, the upcoming bull market and be strategic about the different cycles. What's also for the investors to actually, you know, form their own thesis about Bitcoin and Lightning, because there is going to be a lot of noise that's happening in each of these cycles, where you will have real innovation and you will have kind of the copycats. So being able to understand what's the difference between Lightning and the layer twos and the different scalability offers being made or statements being made, it's critically important that they have a firm grasp of the technology, at least to be able to you know, separate the wheat from the chaff.
Yeah, absolutely, Jesse. And the past few points we were touching on how that early stage venture model is changing is fascinating. I mean, what Lynn was mentioning is just spot on, and we've seen it, right? And just so many of the conversations we're having, it's a completely different mindset, which to your point, Jesse, also makes it extra important to be building relationships with strategic partners early on, right, for you guys. But I mean, the roadmap you guys have is super exciting. I mean, it makes me eager to hear where you guys are at, you know, 6 months to a year from now, and hopefully we can check back in. But how big is the team currently, by the way, Jesse?
We're a team of 8 at the moment. And right now we're recruiting for 2 different positions, another backend developer and a machine learning intern, which will be working on more of the node automation stuff. So people talk about, you know, Lightning's too difficult to use. They have to manage channels. Well, we're very interested in making that go away and build the next generation of autopilot. So it will help individual users make strategic decisions without having to even think about it.
Yeah. I mean, there's just so much opportunity in this space. I mean, I'd love to get your thoughts and more so for, you know, maybe other potential entrepreneurs with other business ideas. I mean, putting it very simply, what you're doing, and to be honest, from my point of view, I think that's exactly the point in the evolution of this technology that we're at, that the biggest gap is on the usability, right? On that user interface or user experience side of the Bitcoin network and its scaling solutions just broadly. And what MVOS is doing is precisely tackling within a niche, of course, right? You're focusing on Lightning Network, a specific layer two. And what you're doing is just taking a lot of this data that already exists, and you're compiling different tools and software tools to make it more usable, predictable. Of course, that has some clear economic benefits as well. But what advice would you have for an engineer, or doesn't necessarily have to be an engineer, but just an aspiring entrepreneur with maybe a couple ideas in their head and thinking, you know, hey, maybe I'm a little late, or there's already others working on this. Any thoughts you have around that topic?
Yeah, there was a book recommended called Rocket Fuel, and that was really about finding the visionary and integrator relationships. So basically, that means find a partner that you can trust, find a co-founder, because, you know, that person will be instrumental to your success. If you've got ideas, you might be a visionary. And if you're able to manage a team and help organize people to actually execute, like, that's going to be, you know, your integrator. And that pair, kind of like Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, that is the dynamic team that you know will be at the root of your company and your company culture. So that's probably the main piece of advice. But also, kind of, the world is your oyster. And so for the folks that are dedicated and are very mission-driven to bring this technology to the world, I would encourage those folks to think about starting a business and organizing the tech and solving real problems for real people.
Just talking about mission, your mission is, I mean, why is it so important to increase adoption of Bitcoin and scale it in your opinion? I'm sure that we've chatted a little bit before, but you know, what is your personal mission in this?
Yeah. I would like to see, you know, the Lightning Network be a high performance, an efficient payment system, you know, for the world. It's, you know, that's building off of Bitcoin. That is, you know, to me, it's freedom money. It's also extremely ruthlessly neutral. So that there's incredible power in that technology. I mean, Bitcoin is a consensus system, something that literally everyone can get behind, everyone that wants to participate. And that's a beautiful thing. And that is completely different than, you know, being subject to someone else's policies, where, you know, you can be in the driver's seat once again and make decisions for yourself. And doing that with neutral tech that is scalable and efficient, yeah, that's the critical piece to bring this and make this reformation happen.
Now, well, I mean, thank you for all the advice there, Jesse. I know we're closing up on time here, but one thing I also wanted to you know, get your opinion on is, how important has it been? I know you moved to Nashville specifically to be maybe a little more integrated with the Bitcoin startup scene there and everything going on at Bitcoin Park. So for listeners who might not be familiar with Bitcoin Park, what is that? And also, how important has it been for you as an entrepreneur to kind of plug into a like-minded community?
I really like the idea of kind of plugging into it, because, you know, Bitcoin Park itself is a network. So it's not only, you know, a co-working space where you can go and, you know, get work done, but it's also a place and has continuously become a destination for people, where we've got people, you know, coming from all over the country and sometimes outside the country just to come to Bitcoin Park, you know, as a community space. And each of those folks that have come, you know, have brought, you know, their unique perspectives, you know, from, you know, being founders themselves, being interested in the technology, or being influential, not only in the technology, but also in the political landscape, which will continually be a front where we've got, you know, many battles ahead on regulatory. So having those established relationships that are kind of leveraging, you know, what the Bitcoin Park founders and leaders have put together, I mean, it's instrumental to us. Also, you know, as a business that really started in COVID and in kind of lockdowns, actually having a space to go was really important for us to actually get together in person and have like an easy way to actually have an office, but have a fully remote, you know, global team. So kind of balancing those two things.
You know, in person is so important. And that's where Jesse and I met just a few weeks ago at the Portland event, Bitcoin is for Everyone. And that was just such a treat to be able to get to meet you and spend time with you. And this is a result of it, because I've heard about Envos, but didn't know you or Tony. And even though now that I'm thinking back, I was at Adopting Bitcoin in 2021, where you were presenting. And my knowledge of Lightning at that time was really emerging. And I found that conference incredibly helpful to really expand how I was thinking about it and get into the technical details a little bit more. So yeah, I wonder if our paths crossed earlier than just a couple of weeks ago, but that was a great conference.
It was great. Yeah, and having more Lightning conferences, I'm really looking forward to that, and having that focus on not only Bitcoin as a store of value, but Bitcoin as a medium of exchange, as a settlement system, really excites me, and I'm looking forward to engaging with, you know, other folks that are similarly see the opportunity for Bitcoin as a payment system.
Will you be at any upcoming events? I'm probably sure you'll be at Bitcoin 2024 in Nashville coming up, since it's your backyard.
I will. Yeah, I'll be speaking there.
Great. Yeah. And other places where people can find you, we'll list them in the show notes, but just to let people know what's the best way to connect with you if they have questions or want to get to know more about AMBO services and plug into the Lightning Network.
Sure. Yeah, you can find our company site at amboss.tech, and you can follow us on Twitter at ambosstech also, on, let's see, now X. And of course, we're on Noster, and then you can follow me at Jestifer_BTC.
Well, Jesse, can't thank you enough. We really appreciate your time and coming on to the Build with Bitcoin podcast. So hopefully we get a chance to have you on back on at a later date. And either way, Lynn and I will be in Nashville in July. So we'll see you soon.
Really appreciate the questions, and thanks for having me.